From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you on our Week in Review. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. For the first time this week, we sat down with a man who might have a near impossible job. Terry Dade is the new superintendent for the Rochester City School District. He comes from Virginia, where he has helped lead a dozen school turnaround projects, and he takes the job at a time of turmoil in Rochester.
Dade's first week on the job was the first week of July, when the debate about a state takeover of the school board was roiling. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren has called for a November referendum that could pave the way for a state takeover of the school board. A judge recently decided that the referendum was illegal. The mayor has told Rochester students that their district leaders don't want them to succeed. I asked Superintendent Dade to describe when the Rochester job hit his radar and whether he's had any regrets about what he's gotten into.
Rochester City first hit my radar back in January of this year.
Of this year.
So pretty far removed from the final interviews in the process.
And the reason I ask that is because I'm curious to know, would you still have pursued this job if you could have foreseen the community debate over a state takeover and everything else that's been sort of roiling this district in the last few months? Would you still have pursued the job?
Absolutely. And I have to say, in all honesty, that a lot of folks tried to steer me away from Rochester City merely with the impact of having a distinguished educator and some of the challenges that Rochester City was experiencing. But like I said, my passion and my love and what I truly feel that I'm being led to do is to serve our most challenged populations, to show what can happen and how you can be an exemplar in urban education with the right leadership and the right partnerships with everyone around you.
To make sure I understand, you're speaking of Jaime Aquino, the distinguished educator who was brought on by New York State and offered an extensive report on the issues that he found facing the district. The advice you were getting was, don't take this job because you might not have a lot of control? Or what was sort of some of the sentiment that you were hearing?
What I was hearing was, with a distinguished educator, there's a lot of implications that could occur as a result of that. With further monitoring, who's in control at the time. So a lot of the concerns that I was hearing coming in were around job security. And I've never taken on a position with me at the forefront of concern. I'm really concerned to do one thing, and that's to provide a high-quality education for our students. So it attracted me almost even more to know that this community really seemed to need a leader who was going to bring people together, rather than to allow it to continue to be a lot of pointing fingers at one another.
Do you think a state takeover of the school board is logical, is a good idea?
Absolutely not. I say that because I'm a researcher at heart. I've looked at districts across the country, and I've not seen that be a successful model. So I'm still looking for that evidence across the country in an urban district like Rochester City, where a state takeover has shown to be promising. So I believe we have the right people right here in Rochester City with a passion and the heart and the dedication to do what's right by our students. And all we need to do is do a better job of coming together to work with one another rather than dividing each other apart.
A decade ago in this community, there were debates about mayoral control. Do you think that would make sense?
I can't speak to mayoral control versus state takeover explicitly. I do have experience where I served in a district that had mayoral control and we were doing well. All that said, I don't believe that right now is the time to change governance structure. We need to stay focused on student learning and our outcomes. And I feel that right now, like we were talking about superintendent turnover, all of that has a consequence and a ripple down effect on our system. And if we were to start talking about governance structure changes, I truly believe that it'll impact our classrooms in a negative manner.
The judge recently weighed in on this possible November referendum. The city has appealed that, and I know that that's largely out of your hands. So we'll have to see what the courts say about a city's appeal on that. What I did notice was our old colleagues at Channel 13, for example, reported that it was just, I think, the same day that you had first met with Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren, and the mayor had said the following about that meeting, and I want to get your take on this. Here's what the mayor told Channel 13. The mayor went so far as to suggest that the superintendent might have been sabotaged by his own school board, because the mayor says she met with you and you didn't give her warning that this lawsuit was coming from the district disputing the referendum. And the mayor says, quote, obviously, and I can't say this for sure, but if you're building a relationship with the mayor and you're having a meeting with her and you know that today or tomorrow or within the next couple of days, she's going to be served with a lawsuit to say, hey, listen, by the way, I want to build a relationship with you. And because I want to build this relationship with you, I want you to know we're going to fight this in court. And that's it. But that never came up. It's interesting that it didn't come up, end quote. That's from the mayor. Why didn't it come up?
First and foremost, I want to be clear with everyone that the purpose of the meeting was a meet and greet. Our first meeting back in July was rescheduled. So this meeting had been on the books for weeks in the making. The decision by the board was made the night before. That was public knowledge. So I was clear with the mayor that I didn't feel that it was my place to discuss a governance issue that far exceeded where my realm of control was. I decided to stay in my lane and stick with, as the superintendent of Rochester City, I shared what my plans were for the district and asked how we could partner to move the school district forward.
Okay. And do you feel like you've got a constructive relationship with the mayor right now?
We had a very brief meeting, so I think much more to come. And I'm hoping that we truly can partner in this work together. I know that I need her. I need city council. I need our team in Rochester City School District to be successful. I made it clear to the board if they were looking for Superman to come in and address all the challenges in the district alone, then I'm the wrong person. I look forward to building bridges and providing partnerships for the city to move forward.
Next up, we mark the passing of one of the greatest writers of all time. Toni Morrison died recently at the age of 88. She won the Pulitzer Prize and has broken ground for African-American writers, particularly women.
We sat down with local writer Leslie C. Youngblood, author of Love Like Sky. In this clip, you'll first hear Toni Morrison speaking about a decade ago about telling the stories of young black girls in her books.
You've got the most vulnerable people in the world, which are children, female children, female black children who have never held center stage in anything. If they appear in a book, they're a joke or, you know, just some color, local color, or a little walk-on part. The least important. Now, black women have sometimes held center stage in some books by blacks, even sometimes by white. But then, you know, they were maids, cooks, housekeepers, you know, they were really running. But the children were always lesser. So I wanted to have a little hurt black girl at the center of this story. And it was difficult because focusing on her only was just too depressing, you know, because you lose some of the thrill of being young. There is some thrill to it, you know.
Yes.
So that's what made me think of you, Leslie C. Youngblood. I have to say, it made me think of Love Like Sky.
You know, and when I think about that, that is what Morrison means to me. It is, even though, as Lou said, they were writers who, of course, wrote about black characters prior to Morrison, Virginia Hamilton, just to name one. But Morrison gave me that permission to say, this is Georgie's story. This is about Georgie. And she's not the best friend. She's not the sidekick. She's not the comic relief. This is her story. And when a black girl specifically holds that book, they can say, this is for me, this is mine. And anyone else who loves it, I love that. But Morrison gave me that permission, that okay, to say, I don't have to explain. And as when we study Morrison, we learn about the white gaze, and we know that there's no explanation to certain things that happen in Love Like Sky because Georgie knows, her family knows. So if I say something like putting Crown Royal or coconut oil in her hair, I don't have to explain that. As with if I was speaking and in directing it to another audience, I would. But Georgie knows, and that's important, and that's what matters.
We're going to get back to that theme of what the white gaze is and what our guests think about that, because Toni Morrison had a lot to say about that in her life. And that was important to her in some ways to understand what that was in context. We're going to get back to that in just a second. But, you know, if you missed the conversation, was it last fall that Love Like Sky came out?
Yes, November 2018.
Yeah, and so one of the parts of the conversation we had with Leslie at the time of the release of the book was the fact that initially the cover might not have included a young black girl.
Right.
But you wanted it to include.
And thank goodness I had an editor that backed me, but the initial cover was a big heart. And the cover, and Georgie was lighter in complexion. And there was also, marketing told me from Disney that this cover would be more marketable, mm-hmm. a more generic cover, not a cover with an African-American, especially a dark-complected African-American girl front and center. People would think it's a black book. But my response to that was, and that's okay. They can think it's a black book. But marketing said, you know, we want to get more buyers. And so at the end of the day, I had to believe that that was okay. My editor believed that it was okay. And
is there a little Toni Morrison in that?
Well, it has to be. I don't even think that, I can't even say that that was my mindset at the moment. But because I knew that that was my audience, and Morrison gives us permission to say that is my audience and that is okay. Not that is my audience and somehow I'm deficient, or that is my audience and somehow is less than. She said, this is my audience, this is okay, and the themes are universal. So it was okay, it should have been okay, and with Love Like Sky, that's just what it was, and I'm excited about it.
Let's close the week with a question. How much do you know about your own neighborhood? Do you know what it looked like 50 or 100 years ago? Do you know how it's changed? In Rochester, just off of Cornhill, you'll find Clarissa Street. It used to be the home to some of the most bustling jazz clubs in the Northeast, including the Pithod. But urban renewal pulled it apart, and the neighborhood changed.
The annual Clarissa Street reunion is happening this weekend, but this year there's something different about the festival. An organization called Teen Empowerment did a little history project. The teenagers met with elders from Clarissa Street who have lived there for decades, and the teenagers found out lessons that the elders want them to learn. They're all attending the reunion festival together. In this clip, you'll hear Moses Gilbert, a longtime resident, talking about the way neighborhoods change.
It's sort of like the concept of the old African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child. In those days, Clarissa Street was like a village, and your mother was my mother, and my father was your father, in the sense of if you did anything naughty, all the adults would tell you so. They might even give you a spanking when you're young enough and send you home to get another one. So we really, our neighbors, our parents were my parents, and so all the children were raised by all of the parents in the neighborhood. It was a safe place as a result in the feeling, regardless of your age. And so as a youngster, you could walk there after dark, and nobody ever thought of any violence that might befall a child playing, going to the store. I mean, there's 5 grocery stores at one time on that strip. It was a pool room. There were restaurants. There were social outlets such as 3 or 4 bars during the length of that strip. It was ice cream parlor, bakery. There were so many things that you did not have to go outside of the neighborhood to get the kinds of supports that you want to go and buy groceries and the likes.
And so now, do you think that these conversations are helping these teenagers in significant ways? What are you hoping they're gaining from learning about this?
Well, mutual respect. Mutual respect that we're friends. We are not enemies because we're the difference in our age. We look forward. Parents, we have to do more of these kinds of projects to help the generations respect each other and interact.
Was it a good place to be for you growing up? Were you happy? Were you happy there?
It was exciting. It was great. We had 2 medical doctors in the neighborhood, Dr. Lunsford, Dr. Jordan. We had all kinds of role models like that, along with our parents. But most of us owned our own homes. Most of us had our neighbors who were looking out for us. We didn't have to leave the neighborhood for much of anything other than go downtown to the department stores. So you felt so safe. You felt like each one was a brother or sister to you, as well as a mother and father.
What would you say was the time of change, the most change? What affected your neighborhood and the area where you lived in Rochester the most?
Well, I think the major project was so-called urban renewal. Now, we had a world-renowned jazz site there, the Pithod. Everybody, I went over in London back in 1984, and there was an American-born artist, a pianist, and he came over and said, oh, we look like Americans to him. And he came over and, oh, where are you from? Oh, Rochester, New York. Hey, I played there. We were real world-renowned with the Pithod, and so not only was it a neighborhood social outlet, but folks came from long distances to listen to the artists, as well as world-renowned artists coming in to play.
And what happened that changed that?
Well, the major change was urban renewal. The decision by the city fathers, the anticipation of the Interloop Expressway coming into the neighborhood. Clarissa Street used to continue all the way into Main Street, West Main Street, and across there. There's a subway station, so where we had a subway, and the stop was at the corner of Clarissa and West Main Street. So urban renewal's plans and what they did broke up the neighborhood.
And so, Moses, sometimes we talk about the Interloop and its dividing line. We talk about urban renewal in sort of abstract ways. You lived there. You saw this happening. Were people, when this was happening, were people talking about it like this is going to wreck the neighborhood or this is going to cause problems, or was this sold as a good thing for everybody? I mean, what was sort of the feeling in the neighborhood when these changes were happening?
Well, there was disappointment expressed starting in 1948 when my dad got a letter saying, we're going to maybe run the expressway through your house. You're going to have to sell your property. Wow. The house still remains. However, you had to don't put big money in repairs of your house because the city's going to take it. Urban Renewal is going to take it. And then for us, Urban Renewal did not take it. But it changed. It did change many of the features of the Southwest.
And so you lost some of what gave the city, this part of the city, its identity. Those clubs that you said you could travel overseas, people were familiar with. Those things started to change. What has been maybe the story of the last 3 to 4 decades or so? I mean, what's happening there now? What do you want to see happen now?
Well, neighborhoods have changed there around America. In our situation, it broke up a neighborhood. A self-supporting neighborhood, both family to family, stores, and social outlets. And many of the homes have been destroyed. Some of them have been replaced with new facilities. But it changed the total character of the neighborhood. You can't go back to the Pithod. It's not there. You can't go back to LaRue's. You can't go back to Vallott's. The grocery stores, the social outlets, and other supporting public programs or businesses, they are gone.
Is anything going to bring them back? Or maybe not the Pithod, and maybe not the grocery stores you grew up with, but could something happen that would change it in a direction that is more community-focused?
Well, the kinds of houses that they're building, they're pretty large as far as the number of people living in them now. The kind of design for the neighborhood. Ford Street basically didn't exist like it is now. And as we know it now, Fourth Street is a Fourth Street Bridge, for instance. That was the Clarissa Street Bridge when we grew up. They changed the name of the bridge. You know, they discontinued Clarissa Street from crossing the river. Those are kinds of physical changes that will not be duplicated.
Okay. And what's it like growing up there now? You loved growing up there. You talked about the excitement. What is it like living there now?
Well, people don't know each other. It's not a neighborhood anymore as we know neighborhoods of yesteryear, again, where everybody was treated one another as family. You don't get that sense nowadays. And neighbors don't know their next-door neighbors. That's sort of like a suburban behavior that we've adopted into the city.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS. That's Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.